Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, about what percentage of New Yorkers earn more than $250,000 a year? Rachel Sherman is an associate professor of sociology at the New School for Social Research in New York. Sherman obtained her bachelor's degree in development studies from Brown University, and she received a master's degree and PhD in sociology from the University of California at Berkeley. Sherman's main area of interest and the focus of her research is structures of inequality in the United States. Her first book, Class Acts, Service and Inequality in Luxury Hotels, analyzes how workers, guests, and managers in luxury hotels make sense of and negotiate class inequalities that mark their relationships. Her second book, Uneasy Street, The Anxieties of Affluence, published in 2017, explores the lived experience of privilege among wealthy and affluent parents in New York City, a subject she had already written articles about for the New York Times, The Guardian, and Quartz. Now Sherman will have the opportunity to expand on her research as one of 31 extraordinary scholars and writers awarded the prestigious Andrew Carnegie Fellowship for 2018. The grant permits fellows to devote their time to significant research, writing, and publishing in the humanities and social sciences. We spoke with Sherman about Uneasy Street and the findings of her research among the wealthy in New York City. Thank you very much for speaking with us today. Could you first tell us a little bit about your own background, what you studied, and so forth?
Sure. When I was an undergraduate in college, I studied development studies, which was sort of like Latin American studies. And I actually lived after college in Santiago, Chile for a couple of years. And then when I started graduate school, I went to Berkeley in sociology. And I studied immigration a little bit. I studied labor. And I wrote a dissertation that was about the hotel, luxury hotels, and work in those hotels. And I actually worked in two luxury hotels myself for about a year. So I'm a sociologist of labor, but recently I have turned more toward looking at consumption and service work as it produces consumption, which has led me ultimately to this project looking at sort of wealthy people and how they understand their own needs and how they make choices about spending money.
Yeah, I noticed that you did do a lot of your earlier research about rich people. For example, what you mentioned about the relationship between guests and workers in luxury hotels. Where did this interest come from?
Well, I think there's two things. I mean, one characteristic of a lot of my work is it's about rich people, but it's about inequality, right? And so I think that, and actually I developed this interest probably when I was in Chile, is to think about the ways in which it becomes okay for so much inequality, for us to have so much inequality in our society, right? So why is that culturally acceptable? And when I was looking, doing the hotel project, I was thinking about how is it that people can sort of serve people who they know have much, much more money than they do in a luxury service where they're really asked to focus in a lot on the specific personality and needs and so on of the hotel guests without being resentful of that person's wealth. So my interest came from the fact that the luxury hotel is a place where wealthy people and non-wealthy people kind of meet in person, which doesn't happen that often. So on the one hand, I was interested in that. On the other hand, I think I have a more personal interest in wealthy people because of my own class background, which I grew up in my parents are divorced, and my mom grew up in an educated working class family or lower middle class family, which she basically didn't have any money, but both of her parents were college educated. And she didn't have a lot of money when I was growing up either. My father comes from a wealthy family. And so I think I've always just been aware of kind of that contrast, right? I've sort of had, you know, a little bit of like a double class upbringing or something like that. And so I think that's one of the reasons that I've been interested in issues of class generally and wealthy people specifically.
Tell us a little bit about this particular project and how you decided who to interview and how you found them.
Well, this project, as I said, I started thinking about the production of consumption, so the ways in which sort of service experts, lifestyle professionals kind of produce lifestyles. They produce their clients' choices about making, about spending money and consumer decisions. And I was interviewing personal concierges, also known as lifestyle managers, who kind of are sort of like personal assistants for wealthy people, except that they typically have multiple clients instead of just having one client. And that led me to study other kinds of lifestyle service experts like financial managers, interior designers, you know, real estate brokers, wedding people who did work at weddings, like those kinds of things. And as I was doing that, I was getting more interested in studying wealthy people themselves and how they understood these consumption decisions, and in particular, how they understood their own needs, right? When you have a lot of money, what is a need and what is a luxury, right? What is something that you kind of can't live without, or in what ways do you feel like you have too much or you don't have enough, or, you know, those kinds of questions. So I started trying to interview wealthy people. Of course, first I had to define what it means to be wealthy. And after a lot of soul searching or thinking about it or whatever, and talking to a number of other sociologists, I decided to make this cutoff $250,000 in annual household income. Many people will say that is not wealthy in New York, it's actually middle class. But the fact of the matter is that it's only about the top 5% of families in New York City that have that income. So it is a much higher income than we think of it as being. The median income at the time in New York was around $50,000. In the U.S. and the nationally also is about $50,000. Now it's a little bit more. So finding those people was difficult, and I think it is partly because, as I argue in the book, you know, people don't really like talking about money. And it was clear from, I wasn't saying to them, I'm going to talk to you about your money, but I was saying, you know, I want to talk about these lifestyle decisions, you know, buying a house, renovating a house, sending your kid to school, those kinds of leisure travel, that kind of stuff. But what I ultimately did was, and it turns out, I mean, I went to an elite college myself, and it turns out that when you do that, you have a lot of friends who are pretty elite. And so I started with people that I already knew, and then through them interviewed, you know, people that they knew, their friends or neighbors, and was able to, we call that snowball sampling, snowball a little bit out from that. So that was mostly how I did it, was just through people that I knew. And of course, that kind of sampling does not generate a representative sample. But I think it's very difficult to get access to people to have real conversations with them through any kind of random sampling that would generate a representative sample. And I also had some entree into a few organizations that kind of represent or organize relatively liberal or progressive people with wealth. Those kinds of organizations include foundations like the North Star Fund, the Astraea Foundation, Resource Generation, which organizes young people with wealth, Patriotic Millionaires, Responsible Wealth. I mean, there are a number of them. So through a couple of those organizations, I was also able to find people to talk to.
You kind of suggest that, at least among some of these wealthy people, there's a kind of a guilty conscience.
Yeah.
You talk at the very beginning of the book about the terms affluent versus wealthy and how you had to be careful what term you used because people might reject, you know, the idea that they're rich, that kind of thing. And also the ideas of legitimate versus illegitimate privilege. Could you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot there. So, yeah, I mean, I thought that affluent meant less wealthy than wealthy, or that affluent was sometimes a euphemism for wealthy. But some people think that affluent and wealthy mean the same thing. But the story that I tell in the book, and this was about a couple of African-American respondents that I used the word affluent in reaching out to them to talk to me, and they both agreed to, and I did this on the advice of the woman who was connecting me to them, who was herself mixed race. And both of these women said, you know, literally, like, as soon as I walked in the door, like, I don't think I'm affluent, you know. And the reason that they didn't think that they were affluent is because, I think it's two reasons. One is they still worry about money. So a lot of people will say that they're not affluent, certainly not wealthy, if they still think about money. So they kind of imagine that, you know, true rich people never think about money. I also think, and what I argue in the book, is that there's a kind of stigma that is attached to affluence in the U.S. I mean, even though, of course, we have the American dream, and there are these sort of, you know, in some ways positive models of wealthy people, and we imagine that everybody here is striving to move up, although I'm not sure that we imagine they're striving to be wealthy, but striving at least to be better off than they currently are, there's also all of these images of wealthy people that are really negative. I mean, you know, ostentatious, materialistic, braggy, obnoxious, self-centered, entitled. That's a word that I talk about and that we hear a lot in the U.S. of sort of like a bad rich person. So all the people that I interviewed were really trying to distance themselves from that. And one way that they did that was by thinking of themselves as not really being affluent. So it's kind of convenient to them to say, well, I'm not really rich, because it allows them to sort of not have to deal with the conflicted feelings that they may have about that, not only because of the negative images of wealthy people, but also because of the inequality that's become so prominent in the political landscape that I think people also feel bad about. And then in response to it's related to the question that you asked about the really feeling guilty. I think the word guilt is attached more to people who have inherited their wealth. And about half the people that I spoke to had some inherited wealth. About 25% of the people I spoke to, and I may not have said that I talked to 50 people in 42 households, all of which had children, so they're all parents. About 25% of those people were living off of their own inherited wealth, right? Some people have inherited wealth and they also have very high-paying jobs, but about a quarter of these people. And those are the people, and they tend, you know, the ones that I interviewed tend to be politically progressive. They're using this money to work in nonprofits or academia or the arts, but they still, you know, have fairly expensive lifestyles. Those people tend to have more something that they were be more likely to call guilt. I think that the rest of the people I talked to, I'm not sure that they felt guilty, but what I argue in the book is that all of these people, I mean, you know, some of them, as I said, working in the arts or in academia with very progressive politics and inherited wealth, and then on the other end, you know, relative for New York, relatively conservative people who are voting Republican, working in finance, you know, moved in very different circles. These people were very different in many ways, but across the board, I would say that they wanted to be morally worthy of their wealth. So for the guilty inheritors, that, you know, they're more open in the ways that they talk about their feelings of guilt, and they feel guilt more because they have not earned the money that they have. But even the people who are in earners themselves are in earning families, typically women married to earners, talk about a variety of ways in which it becomes okay to have money if you work hard, if you consume reasonably, if you give back, if you're aware of your privilege, and if you raise children with these same kind of good values.
There are three general areas of your findings that I would like to speak about. The first one, which you touched on before, is consumption. Mm-hmm. You talk about needs. Now, how would you compare the needs that you found with middle-class needs? Because it seems to me that everybody has the same so-called need to buy stuff, but may not spend as much money on it. I mean, I think that in the middle class also, and even in the working class, there's a lot of conspicuous consumption. I mean, you've got to have that pair of sneakers or, you know, brand names, or taking kids on trips during school vacations. So my question to you is, at a different level, isn't it a similar phenomenon?
Well, the phenomenon you're talking about being a consuming conspicuously, or?
Well, no, I mean feeling a need to consume, to buy things or to spend money on things that are not really just basic necessities, but either to impress somebody or to show that you can do it or whatever. I mean, I don't think anybody really needs to have brand name, whatever, clothes, right, or whatever.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, of course, people spend something, you know, on things that you would not consider needs and that many people would not consider needs, probably in every social class, right? I mean, the question, though, so I'm not saying that that is particular to wealthy people, and I'm actually not even saying anything about whether people spend more than they need to spend, right? What I'm saying is, A, I think it's really difficult for us to decide what's a necessity, right? Who decides that? I mean, There are many things that I think are necessary that other people with the same amount of money that I have probably wouldn't think of as necessities, right? So what's interesting to me is that the people that I'm interviewing are trying to frame their spending as spending on necessary items. So they talk about, you know, they justify it in terms of their family spending, you know, they're in terms of spending on kids, or, you know, they would never have renovated the house if they weren't having a child, or if the kid didn't need, you know, its own bathroom, or they talk about spending a lot of money on organic food for the children. They talk about, and they talk about their needs as basic. This spending is basic. You know, they'll often would say, we have dinner at home with the family, you know, we're not out going to a fancy restaurant, like those sort of, I'm not making a judgment about whether they're spending beyond their needs or not. I don't have an opinion about that. I just am interested in the way that they're, what, that's my argument about being morally worthy, is that to be morally worthy, you need to not be spending ostentatiously, or, you know, you need to not be profligate. You're not supposed to be spending, certainly not beyond your means, but even in a way that's really obvious or on something that's stupid or self-indulgent, right? So they're trying to frame their own consumption in that way. And that's what I think is the this idea that, I have in the book of aspiring to the middle, which is partly, I think, what you're responding to, is that they're kind of portraying their own spending as if it were middle class, right? These are needs common to everyone. Like, I had a dad who's like, oh, you know, he and his wife, and they were among the wealthiest people in the sample. They were spending, when I interviewed him, $600,000 a year spending generated by his family. Later, when I interviewed her, they were spending $800,000 a year. But what he said to me, you know, I say to my wife, is this, do you think, feel like this is the $600,000 lifestyle? Like, woohoo, you know? Then he said, I'm running around, I'm frantic, I'm making peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. So he's alluding to this, you know, like, I work hard, I'm busy, I'm just making sandwiches for my kids, like any other parent, right? There's often this kind of unspoken coda, like, that is like any other parent. And so that sort of, if we can feel like we're in the middle, we don't need to feel guilty or conflicted or really recognize that we have so much more than so many other people.
Yeah, something else that you deal with in the book is volunteering, especially people who have inherited their wealth and maybe aren't working, or stay-at-home moms. And you mention, of course, that some people feel that this is a kind of a noblesse oblige, but isn't volunteering really a main part of the American ethic in general?
Yes. I mean, yeah, I think giving back, this notion of giving back that a lot of them would emphasize, I don't think is particular to the upper class, right? I think we often just say, like, it's important to give back, and we want to teach kids to give back. And so, yeah, I think that that's an idea that's very widespread. And again, the argument that I'm trying to make in the book is that they are articulating and appealing to ideas that are widespread in American culture, right? That it's good to work hard, that it's important not to show off your money, that you should give back. Those kinds of things are very widespread. So I'm not at all suggesting that these are particular only to wealthy people.
The next thing that I thought was very interesting was the relationship of husbands to wives, the whole power issue, which of course is not limited to to any particular strata, no, and as far as money goes or anything else. You have husbands who earn a lot, who earn extra, who don't need all the money that they earn, and yet they control their wives' spending, especially if the wives are stay-at-home moms. And it's almost a power thing, almost that kind of a control, because they don't have to worry about money. And also the relationship in couples where in which women bring in more money than the men, which is something that I think you find also among middle class families, middle class people. And recognition of, in some cases, there was recognition of non-monetary contributions to the family if the woman wasn't working and earning money. But could you speak a little bit about the whole power thing and the whole relationship area?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think you just hit sort of the high point of that. Although, I mean, my argument is that thinking especially about the stay-at-home mothers in the sample, and there are, you know, something around a third of a sample is women who do not have paid employment, and they all did, you know, work as, they have advanced degrees. Two-thirds of them have advanced degrees. They're all college educated. You know, they worked in law and finance. I mean, so they had higher power jobs themselves. Now they don't work and their husbands are making, you know, 500,000, a million, 2 million and up per year. So in some cases, I think there is a way in which their husbands recognize them as doing legitimate work, right? And these are women who I think are fighting against a stereotype of stay-at-home moms as self-indulgent, lazy, shallow, you know, obsessed with how they look, just going to, you know, spin class all the time and neglecting their children and having nannies do all their household labor and that kind of thing. So they're always trying to emphasize that what they do is work and that they're not consuming in this sort of over-the-top way, and that they do a lot of volunteer work. Those are the kinds of things they'll talk about with me. And some of them, the husband thinks like, yeah, that's right. You are working hard. You're raising the children and you're maintaining our household and you are, you know, doing all this kind of consumption labor that is actually meaningful, right? So one woman said, my husband will say, you know, I could never do my job if you weren't doing this job, right? They'll talk about themselves as the CEO of the home. But there are definitely some women whose husbands don't really see it that way. And I think are critical of the wives' spending. They don't see this, the consuming that the women are doing on behalf of the family as really benefiting the family, right? They just see it as like, why are you spending all my money? And I don't think, I mean, again, you just characterize this as these are people who have more than they need, right? But that involves a judgment that you're making about how much they need. So they don't necessarily think that they have more than they need. And I think some of these men are really kind of nervous about losing their jobs or spending beyond their means or not being able to, you know, send their kids to college. And that's a, you know, we can be sympathetic or not to that as a fear, but I think it is a real fear. And I think that in, you know, these are families that have one breadwinner who, if he loses his job, you know, they're not going to, they have, you know, two or three kids in private school usually, which is, you know, $50,000 a year per kid. So to me, it's not insanely unreasonable to, once you've established this kind of lifestyle, to be nervous about it. That is not to justify, of course, that they're kind of acting like their contributions are the only meaningful contributions. But that's something that causes some conflict in these families. And then the other thing that you mentioned is what happens in families where there's two earners or where a woman is an inheritor, right? And the woman is bringing more to the table than the man. And in that case, you know, women talk about basically having to compensate for the ego demands of men who, you know, in the case of female inheritors, transferring money to them, you know, the men don't feel like it's really their money to, they don't feel entitled to make decisions about how that money is going to be spent for the future. And so women sort of talk about transferring money to their husbands. They also, women earners, I mean, I only interviewed a couple of women who actually earned more than their husbands did. And only one of them really had a sort of a conflict in her marriage about it. But yeah, I think it was, she had to sort of go, she let him manage their money. I mean, she made literally 10 times as much money as he did. And she sort of let him manage it as a way of him contributing. So this idea of contribution is very strong in all of these cases. It's like, who's contributing? How do we understand what a contribution to a family is? Does it have to be in the form of money or can it be in some other way?
This next issue I would call almost philosophical. What is success? I think that the people who you spoke with consider money a measure of success. In other words, you're successful means having a lot of money. And the people who earned their wealth, as opposed to the inheritors, chose to go into high-earning professions.
Right.
Probably because their goal was to earn a lot of money. We don't know if they enjoyed what they were doing as a job, because some of them seem to complain that they don't have any free time, that they're never home, that they work 20 hours a day. That doesn't sound like fun, but they're making a lot of money. So they must consider themselves successful. And I'm wondering if you got into that at all. I mean, how many of these people actually enjoyed the work?
Yeah, I mean, the one place where I feel like I didn't interview enough people is in interviewing people who are actually the ones earning high amounts of money themselves, usually men, right, in these families. So I only have a few of these male earners. More often I was able to speak to the wives, precisely because these men are working all the time. Although I think men are also maybe more private about money, and I interviewed several women I interviewed said, like, oh, my husband would kill me if he knew I was talking to you, or I'm not going to tell him I talked to you. Or, you know, a couple of them said, like, oh, of course my husband will, you know, is happy to do an interview. And then later it's like, oh, no, he doesn't want to do it. So that might be have something to do with it also. So I don't have a great answer to that question of how these earners themselves think about success. I think that they probably do think about money as being an indicator of success. And because that's correlated to the kind of position that they have in their firm, you know, that's also a kind of indicator of success. But I certainly, the people that I actually did talk to, I think they would mostly deny that money is, certainly they would say that money is not the most important thing to them, right? And that's another way that they're kind of trying to be down to earth. And so who knows if money is the most important thing to them and they just don't want to admit it to me, or actually money isn't the most important thing to them and it's through a series of choices or coincidences that they've ended up in situations with money. Certainly, you know, liberal inheritors, I think, feel like that. I don't think that they would ever say that money is the most important thing to them.
Well, that's because they have it also.
Right. Well, that's the thing. Yeah, it is because they have it. But I think the question of success is one that I just didn't really ask that. You know, I just don't quite know how they would define that, except to the extent that what I'm sure that they care about is being, you know, legitimately privileged, right? That they care that their social advantages and their privilege, they want to not be the bad kind of rich people, you know? And so they're constantly sort of distancing themselves from the stereotypical images that we have of that.
Did you run into any special problems when you were doing this research project?
I mean, as I alluded to before, yeah, it was hard to find these people. So that was part of it. It was initially, again, as I said, it was a little bit difficult to decide how to define wealthy people. And I realized later that many of the obstacles that I ran into along the way in writing the book, I mean, in researching the book, are sort of indicators themselves of how fraught money is in our society. So, you know, it's not obvious what it means to be wealthy because that's a relative term. So it's like, who are you thinking about it in relation to? It's hard to talk about money so it was hard for me to find people who would be willing to talk to me. And, you know, even within the interviews themselves, like it's hard to get people are uncomfortable saying what their income is or what their assets are or how much money they've spent on certain things. So sometimes, you know, took some finesse to get people to talk about that, those issues. And then I felt, you know, again, my own reactions to these people and these sort of discourses that they're offering are complicated because I think we have culturally complicated attitudes toward wealthy people. So I was really trying not to be judgmental of them, but it's almost impossible to talk about wealthy people without judgment, right? It's hard to tell stories about them without seeming to be making fun of them. Especially when they involve like huge amounts of money. And so people have reacted to this book, you know, friends of mine who were reading it along the way or colleagues, you know, some people will say like, you're being too nice to these rich people. And some people would say like, you know, why are you being so mean to these rich people? And so the idea, and really the idea that I'm trying to ultimately get across in the book is that our individual judgments of like, are these people good rich people or bad rich people, right? Is Bill Gates a good rich person and Donald Trump is a bad rich person, or, you know, Warren Buffett is a good rich person and Kim Kardashian is a bad rich person. I mean, these are often the bad rich people are associated with consumption habits, which are associated with women, and the good rich people are associated with entrepreneurialism, which is much more likely to be found at this levels among men, right? So the Bill Gates, the Steve Jobs, Buffett, those are people who have, you know, are seen to have made their own money. And in the case of Buffett, spend it wisely, or in the case of Gates, you know, give it away, give a lot of it away, right? So these are the more positive images that we have, which I think are easier to attain if you are male. But I'm just saying that that all that kind of conversation is very distracting. And we see a lot of it in popular culture in the U.S. too. The franchise of the, you know, quote unquote, Real Housewives of Atlanta or Beverly Hills or New York or wherever. You know, all these kinds of TV shows about rich people that generally propagate these relatively negative images of them and certainly reinscribe ideas about good and bad wealthy people, that like, that's not the thing we should be talking about. The thing we should be talking about is, why do we have such wealthy people to begin with? Like, from my perspective, if you have $70 billion, I don't care whether you're a nice person and you give it back. I just don't think that you should have that much money when there's people, you know, a pretty significant number of people who have nothing, right? So that's where I'm kind of trying to reorient this conversation is away from these judgments of individuals and toward judgments of systems that are producing these kind of massive levels of inequality in the US and now, you know, worldwide.
Are you working on anything now? Are you going to continue with this subject more in depth? Do you have any plans for the future?
Yes, I've only very incipient plans for the future, but I was actually just awarded an Andrew Carnegie Fellowship, which means I'm going to be able to spend some research time on another book, which is going to be about this notion of entitlement. And I'm really interested in the idea of entitlement because, on the one hand, it's, you know, rich people are entitled, it always means that they're bad, right? And that because they imagine that they should have something that other people shouldn't have, not on the basis of something legitimate like hard work, but on the basis of something illegitimate like just they should have it because they're better than other people or something. So that's at the top. And then at the bottom, the idea of entitlement in the US is, you know, it's welfare, which is stigmatized and, you know, racialized. So we have this idea of like, you know, poor people that are dependent on the state and have to be made to work and stuff. So I'm just really interested in the way that the entitlement, it's almost always negative and kind of illegitimate. Whereas, of course, in Europe and elsewhere, the idea of entitlement is just, you know, it's kind of neutral. It's just like the thing you get from the state, and it's fine that the state is providing for people's welfare because that's what the state is there for. So I'm thinking about, but now instead of thinking about like why, what are the sort of cultural processes that make it okay to have wealth, which is what this book is about and what my previous book about hotels, you know, both of those are about sort of how the cultural system of legitimation is reproduced or continues. Now I'm more interested in places where it's challenged. So, you know, where is it okay to say like, you know, no, we're not going to just be individuals in markets and let the rewards kind of be distributed by the so-called, you know, free hand of the market, but where we have expectations of better treatment from employers or whatever. And I think that this is, you know, something you've seen in the US in terms of the teacher strikes, which are coming out of nowhere, and in these very Republican states, suddenly teachers are saying, like, we deserve more than this. And it's also happening in, you know, the whole Me Too movement is essentially a movement of women saying, you know, we are entitled to not be treated this way. Black Lives Matter is a movement of, you know, people of color being saying African Americans specifically in this case, being like, you know, we're also entitled to not be murdered by police. So, you know, that question of what people deserve and how we decide that socially, I think is really, really important right now at this moment of these, you know, really glaring inequalities. So that's the thing I'm going to think about, although I don't have anything to say about it really yet.
Is there anything else you'd like to add that we might have left out?
No, I don't think so. I think we've covered a lot of it. I really appreciate your interest in the book.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is English Corner at radiosefarad.com. See you next week.